Welcome back to The Byword. We're hitting you with so much water imagery this time that you're guaranteed to have to go to the bathroom. As we review Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, The Byword starts now. Ladies and gentlemen, nerds, welcome to a brand new episode of the Nerd Byword Podcast, the only podcast that sounds amazing no matter where you are, at home, at work, in the car, or even sitting on the toilet. In this week's episode, we will be talking about Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, the swan song of the old DC Extended Universe. But first, as always, it's time for... Chris, this is some quite exciting news you're bringing to the table this week.
Yeah, absolutely. The 40th anniversary of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is gearing up for a great year. So we have, fresh off the heels of the success of Mutant Mayhem from last year, we have series and sequels in the works for that. But then also news broke this past week that fan favorite and selling superstar The Last Ronin is in the works to get an R-rated live action adaptation by Walter Hamada, which is no stranger to the geek sphere with how things ended, unfortunately, at Warner Brothers. But Tyler Burton-Smith, who co-wrote the upcoming R-rated action movie Boy Kills World and the 2019 Chucky horror franchise Child's Play, is penning the script here. The Last Ronin famously tells of one of the turtles. I don't know that I want to spoil something that's been out for a couple years. One of the turtles who is the last surviving member of the family and has to deal with the survivor's guilt, and still in this futuristic New York City, deal with the never-ending perils of the Foot Clan. It was the second highest selling graphic novel of 2023, and it was coming out between 2020 and 2022, so still selling very strong. We recently had a kind of in-betweenquel series of The Lost Years and then The Last Ronin 2 Re-Evolution, a straight sequel, had a strong debut issue with 140,000 copies ordered. So it's a very exciting time to be a turtle fan, and I know that we had news reports of a video game being in the works, but a live action especially is really intriguing thing to think about.
Yeah, I agree. I've not read The Last Ronin yet. It's on my to-read list, but I haven't quite made it there yet. And I have to admit, I think it's fascinating that you know, Hollywood is apparently starting to show some willingness to go off the beaten path, right? Instead of doing a very traditional, you know, Ninja Turtles movie, that they're actually willing to take a quote-unquote Elseworlds story, basically, and make a movie out of that, I think is really interesting. If you look over at what's happening with Superman 2, where the official logo was unveiled, and it is not the traditional S, but really a symbol that is more inspired by Kingdom Come, I think it's actually really fascinating that these companies are starting to look a little bit outside of what we could call quote-unquote main continuity for interesting takes on these characters. I'm very, very interested to see where this is going, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Dave, what do you have for us this week? We've got more Nintendo news.
Yeah, so we've been sort of diving in and out of the story related to Nintendo's recent crackdown on emulation, specifically its targeting of the makers of the emulators Yuzu, which was a emulator for Switch, as well as Citra, which was an emulator for the 3DS. Obviously, these were sort of open source projects, and so the code is out there. And it was not surprising that some people immediately tried to take up, you know, the development of these, you know, kind of emulators. And so, interestingly enough, there were two branches, forks of Yuzu that were apparently starting to be worked on. One was referred to as Suyu, which I think is a very unfortunate name choice, given what happened to Yuzu, as well as Sudachi. And these two emulators spawned after Nintendo broke up the Yuzu gang back in early March. And now, according to The Verge, Discord has shut down everything connected to those two projects. So they were apparently using Discord to communicate with fans of the projects, as well as with each other for, you know, programming purposes. And Discord just basically shut the whole thing down. So according to The Verge, the people involved in developing these emulators received quote-unquote vague messages from Discord about how they were passing around content that reportedly violated IP rights, which according to Discord's parent company is a normal process for a DMCA takedown. Now the developers have since complained a little bit about that, because they're saying that you know, the emulators themselves are not, you know, copyright infringement, and you can't, you know, even use them unless you dump your own files from your own Switch. And it's you know, again, just a big old mess. It's very clear, though, I think, from these actions that Nintendo has pretty much had it when it comes specifically to Switch emulation. As somebody who has always had a deep respect for the emulation scene as far as, like, video game preservation is concerned, or making games that are no longer playable any other way accessible again, it's very clear that Nintendo, at least in the reading I have done so far, has not targeted any other emulation projects unless they were specifically related to the current console, the Nintendo Switch. So there's all sorts of emulators flying around out there for various older Nintendo systems, and nary a word or a peep on that as far as I can tell. It's not exactly killing the emulation scene or anything what Nintendo's doing right now, but it's very, very targeted specifically at current gen emulation with the Nintendo Switch. And the reasoning is very much, I think, Tears of the Kingdom, right? Because The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom was actually leaked about a week and a half before its May 12th, 2023 launch. And according to numbers submitted by Nintendo in their original filing of their lawsuit against Yuzu, they believe that within that week and a half, this illegal leak was downloaded over 1 million times. Now, obviously, Tears of the Kingdom ended up, you know, selling over 20 million copies, but a million people who may not have bought the actual release because they were able to use a leaked copy via an emulator is obviously going to affect their bottom line. So I think it's pretty clear that this Tears of the Kingdom leak and the availability of Yuzu in relation to that really jump-started Nintendo to specifically target Switch emulation. What's your take on that, Chris?
This is wild. I mean, like, I'm still trying to wrap my head around all of this because it's simply something that I don't get involved with. And so the fact that Nintendo is a corporation that is so in control of over their IP. I even saw jokes about someone had posted a Mario tattoo, and someone had said, like, they're pulling up at their house, like Nintendo is pulling up at their house for a Mario tattoo. So I like, again, this is all kind of me kind of taking a drink from a fire hose and learning all of this stuff. But it's incredibly crazy because, you know, as a Nintendo consumer, I was having conversations the other day with one of my students, is like, why are Nintendo games still so expensive? And I explained that, like, they don't have really any incentive to lower the prices. You have these standalone games like Super Smash Bros. That's not been really updated in years, is still full price. And the only way you're going to get some kind of discount is if you're going secondhand market. So this it's just crazy to me, and not all that surprising, to be honest, now that you take all of those things into consideration.
The relationship between Nintendo and its fans is very fraught, because especially, I think, say in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years or so, a lot of fandom expression has become really across the board, not just for Nintendo, but for really any franchise, has become fan creations, right? And if we go ahead and we just go ahead and take, you know, the whole Yuzu emulator and you put it over here and even not think about emulation for a second, you know, the amount of stuff of, like, you know, people going on YouTube and trying to, you know, remix Nintendo video game music, or fan projects creating like little fan comic strips or something like that. It's actually quite sad how often Nintendo will, you know, strike people like that who are expressing their fandom with DMCA takedown, as if what they're creating is in direct competition with them, right?
Right, right.
You know, I'm even eyeballing stuff like fan games. AMSR was a Metroid 2 remake that was released for PC, and as far as I know, there was like no profit or anything involved with that. It was just a fan that literally remade the you know, Nintendo Game Boy Metroid 2 with, you know, more modern graphics and you know, some gameplay and you know, it's kind of improvements. But because apparently they were working on their own remake, which eventually came out, I think, for 3DS and was called Metroid Samus Returns. They struck that fan game down, you know, viciously. It's still out there. I mean, if you know where to look. But it's one of those moments where fans create as an expression of their fandom. You know, it's an expression, I think, of love of these franchises and of Nintendo properties. And Nintendo doesn't seem to quite understand when to turn, you know, away from that and let fans be fans, because that those fan projects can actually help their IPs stay in the public light, you know, and in the public eye, and when to actually defend their copyright. Now, with this Yuzu thing, there were some things going on here that I can certainly understand why they would get iffy with it, specifically that the developers, you know, created a Patreon and were starting to take money, you know. I mean, that it's not a fan project at that point. They're trying to directly compete. But just as a general thing of the relationship between Nintendo and their fans, I think Nintendo would benefit greatly from looking the other way for certain things every once in a while, especially considering how many of their franchises often lay dormant for years and years and years before they ever make another entry in the franchise. You know, if you look at the vast breaks between Metroid games, for example, or the fact that there hasn't been an F-Zero game in what, a decade at least now? Those sorts of things being kept alive and in the eye of the public through fan expressions would be a good thing for them, because it keeps things alive that they might not actively be working on but want to return to at some point. So I don't know. I wish they had a better relationship with fan expression, I guess.
It'd be wild to think that DC or Marvel would, like, target a cosplayer or something like that. I guess that's where my brain goes to for something similar.
Yeah, a DMCA takedown because you're wearing a Superman T-shirt or something. I don't know, man. It just seems a little intense sometimes. Alrighty, folks, there you have it. That's it for Nerd News. What do you think of the Last Ronin movie that might be on the horizon, as well as Nintendo's actions against Switch emulation? Find us on social media and let us know. You can find us anywhere that there is social media, at Nerd by Word, and individually at That Nerd Dave and at That Nerd Chris. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to dive into Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, the swan song of the DCEU. So stick around. And we're back, and it's time for one of our patented movie reviews as we dive deep into one specific movie in this week's... And that movie, of course, will be Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom is, by all accounts, the final movie in the DCEU continuity. Here is a quick blurb of the plot. After failing to defeat Aquaman the first time, Black Manta wields the power of the mythic Black Trident to unleash an ancient and malevolent force. Hoping to end his reign of terror, Aquaman forges an unlikely alliance with his brother Orm, the former king of Atlantis. Setting aside their differences, they join forces to protect their kingdom and save the world from irreversible destruction. The movie was released on December 22nd, 2023. The director is James Wan, who also directed the first Aquaman movie and is probably most notable as a director of various horror projects. Yeah, so as we usually do when we review a movie, we each have selected three things we quite liked about the movie and three things that we didn't enjoy so much, and then we will decide on a final grade for the movie. So, Chris, let's go ahead and dive in first and foremost with your first like. What did you enjoy about Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom?
I felt like this was like a peak 80s era comic book. Like, it almost felt like, I don't know if a single issue, probably like a 3 or 4 issue arc of like a Chris Claremont X-Men book. Like, the camp was there. It really went for it when it came to character design of the Atlantean or the ocean creatures. Like, the Brine King was a really, really fun character to have continue popping up for like comedic relief, but also just visually a really cool thing to go for. So yeah, it was a fun ride, and I felt like it was like a peak 80s comic book.
Yeah, I think there was definitely a sense that they were trying to have fun with this and not be too self-serious. I would say probably the first one was a little bit more serious and a little bit more, it had a little bit more of an epic trajectory, I guess you could say. You know, there was a lot going on in that first one, you know, with the, you know, Aquaman first, you know, encountering Atlantis and all that. A lot of political intrigue with Orm's fear of him trying to claim the throne and all that. I thought there was a lot there that probably made the first one a little more epic fantasy, I guess. This one really felt almost kind of like a Star Wars movie, I guess, you know, like a little more lighthearted, a little more jokey, but at the same time still trying to, you know, create a fairly epic movie. I think it ended up being overall fun. I had my problems with the movie, I'm not gonna lie, but at the end of the day, I think it was probably a much better outing than something like The Flash, right? I mean, I had significantly more fun with this movie than I did with The Flash.
Yeah, and like a peak Star Wars film, there was a lot of politicking going on, and some of those council meetings were actually interesting and intriguing.
Yeah, I think I can agree with that.
All right, Dave, what is your first like of Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom?
Although I think it was pushed a little bit into the background this time, I still really like the general feel of the underwater kingdoms, the world that was set up. I think here a Star Wars comparison works yet again. I think that it really, they went a long way in trying to create something that felt otherworldly, almost alien. The scene where they go to like that pirate or smuggler hangout or something almost felt like sort of a Mos Eisley cantina kind of moment, if you know what I mean, right? Like really showing off how weird the underwater world is. I really appreciated that from the word go in the first movie too. They put some thought and some effort into visually distinguishing the underwater world. So it feels like something that could exist underwater, sure, and you have giant, you know, crustaceans and stuff, but there's also something very beautiful and alien about it. And I really appreciated that. That's something I really like about this movie. It's not as much in the forefront as it is in the first one, because this is not a movie of a character first encountering that world or something, right? And I wished maybe there would have been a little bit more of that. It felt like they spent quite a bit of time on the surface in this one, if you get my meaning, on that island and in those caves and all that stuff. There was a lot of surface stuff going on here. But what was going on still underwater, I really liked.
Yeah, and I was thinking, like, it was like during one of those underwater scenes, it obviously you are always going to draw these comparisons between Namor and Arthur, but I was thinking about how distinctly different both Atlantis feels in Black Panther Wakanda Forever and then these two films. And I appreciate the differences and the fact that they're not like a carbon copy of one another, and that they are both distinctly unique and they both are ambitious and they go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's something almost high fantasy, I think, about the way the Aquaman movies approach Atlantis. And that's not quite the tack that they took with in Wakanda Forever. And I think it's a good difference to make, because I think the comic book Namor maybe feels a little bit closer to this Aquaman vibe that we got in this movie. And so going in a different direction and distinguishing them, I think, was a really good move ultimately.
Well, Namor's just more of an a-hole.
Yeah, although I will say there are scenes in this movie where Arthur kind of is too. he doesn't quite come across the way comic book Arthur necessarily does, but we can get to that later. All right, Chris, what was your second like of Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom?
I think for me, probably the strongest element of the film overall was Yahya Abdul-Mateen as Black Manta. There are elements of it that we'll discuss in our dislikes, but I mean, he's cooking. His descent into this corruptive force, and he makes a lot of good grandstandy villain, just menacing kind of behaviors, and I ride for it. And comic book movies kind of go the way of the quality of comic book movies go the way of the quality of their villain. I think a lot of times there's a direct correlation there. And so in a movie that is not perfect, as we'll discuss in a moment, I think this does a lot of heavy lifting, because I think he's incredible. And it makes me very excited and hope that they continue with this Wonder Man series over in the MCU, because I'm excited to see more of him in a superhero product. And it also reminds me, I need to go back and watch Watchmen.
You know, it's interesting because villains have been sort of a hot topic, I think, in comic book movies, in that many of them feel really undercooked and half-baked, right? And so I would say that Black Manta here is sort of approaching high evolutionary levels in Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Like, really menacing, well-acted, decent motivation, interesting performance, you know, the right actor for the job, I think. I think there were writing failures in the character, which we can talk about in the dislikes. But the performance and interpretation of this character, and for a good three quarters of the movie, I think he was about as spot-on as you're going to get. Really, really great villain, I think, for this movie. And I agree that it's probably my favorite part of this movie was the villain performance. It was really, really good.
Dave, this next element that you're getting ready to talk about is something that I directly texted you about and was just awesome to see develop.
Yeah, there's a handful of scenes in this movie where James Wan really brings his horror movie making talents to the fore as a way of making the villains more terrifying. And I think that works really well. I really wish that more comic book movies would look to the horror genre as a way of improving movie making when it comes to making their villains menacing, right? I think there are movie making techniques from the horror genre that would be very effective in comic book movies for exactly that purpose. And James Wan definitely gets the assignment. He understands the assignment here. So there are several scenes, particularly like with the Lost Kingdom's population being turned into monsters and that stuff. There was some good stuff there. I thought that was very enjoyable and gave the movie a unique vibe compared to other comic book movies. I wish there would have been a little bit more of it, maybe. It always felt like we just got a little taste of it. It reminds me a little bit of of Sam Raimi on Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. Like, there are scenes where you get, like, horror Sam Raimi just a little bit, but then they always pulled back from it. And I wished back then, and I wish with this movie too, that they would let the filmmaker cook a little bit more in that genre, if that makes sense. There was good stuff there, but I really ended up feeling like I wanted more.
Yeah, absolutely. That first descent into the Lost Kingdom, where you're in the Arctic and this monster appears, like, it was some peak horror elements that were legitimately terrifying, and I truly appreciated it, and the fact that it stood out from other comic book movies. I think we're at the stage, and we have been for quite some time, where we're at such an influx of superhero films that we're going to have to start standing out. And even the best comic book series do this. They stand out as like a subgenre type of thing. If it's whether it's horror, whether it's epic adventure, whether it's geopolitical machinations, like, something has to make it stand out from just other comic books or comic book movies.
I agree with that. And I think that's one of the big problems I think we've talked about with the MCU right now before, is that so many of the movies feel so formulaic and samey. I have high hopes. This almost was my news story, because I read some coverage of the new Captain America movie, Brave New World. And what I've been reading about, it seems to very much indicate that this is a movie that harkens back to the tone of something like Winter Soldier, sort of an espionage thriller kind of movie with mm-hmm. superheroes. And if they nail that tone again, I think that's something that's been sorely missing from comic book movies lately. Because I would say, arguably, not maybe for scale or epicness, but just pound for pound really nailing a subgenre, I think Winter Soldier is probably the best Marvel movie in my book. Hot take maybe, but I really love that
movie. No, I don't think it is.
And so harkening back to that kind of vibe again after all of these very samey, tonally samey superhero movies that they've been doing, very much traditional cape stories, I think is going to almost come across as a breath of fresh air, harkening back to something that people really enjoyed about the MCU when they were trying to really diversify tones for a little while there. So, yeah, I totally agree. This is exactly what we need. And that's one of the reasons why I just wanted more of that here, you know?
Yeah, there. I have my reservations about that film, the character of Sabra in particular, given the current state of everything that's happening in the real world. And choosing to feature that character if those rumors are indeed to be believed, and then, like, you have, like, all these reshoots and cuts from the film, so I have some trepidations about that movie, but I'm hoping that it works out, because I'm a fan of Sam Wilson as a character, and I'm hoping. Falcon and the Winter Soldier was deeply disappointing in a lot of regards, and so I'm hoping they can turn that one around.
I hope so too. All right, Chris, that brings us to your final like of Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom.
So this is a double-edged sword for me, because there are elements of this observation that will show again in the dislike category, but also it's the comparison is a film that was really formative to my childhood, and I greatly enjoyed. So I said that this movie is Tommy Boy 2 Under the Sea. Like, I just get the same David Spade, Chris Farley dynamic. Like, you have Momoa playing this fun-loving, zest-for-life type of character and trying to get the straight man to loosen up and live a little. And so that's the dynamic I got. And ultimately, the fun-loving character wins them over. Now, there are drawbacks that I'll get to in a minute with this, but it really helped me just kind of stop being so overly critical of something and just sit back and enjoy the ride, I think, for this film, which is probably intentional on the creative theme's behalf.
Yeah, you can kind of feel what they were going for in the formative stages of this movie. It's very much sort of a mismatched characters. Sort of a almost buddy cop kind of thing, you know, that they used to do in the 80s, this mismatched buddy cops road trip movie. So I think Tommy Boy is probably as good of a comparison as anything else, right? Mismatched characters on a road trip stuck together but have to accomplish some goal. I think that's fair. I don't think it always works as well as I would like, which is probably the same problem you're having while you have some trepidations with this comparison. But I understand what they were going for, and I think it's a really solid idea for a superhero movie. But it's all in the execution, so although I like the underlying idea, I don't think it necessarily clicked as well as I would have liked in execution, maybe, I guess is the best way to put it.
All right, Dave, I really love this observation from you, because immediately when we had multiple tridents on the scene, I was hyped, and from the very first blow, I was excited.
Yeah, I think the final fight. Now, with one exception, is there's a turning point in the fight that I didn't appreciate, but a huge chunk of the final fight, particularly between Arthur and Black Manta, is really, really solid. I think it has really, really strong choreography. It's very high energy. It's very fast moving. It almost feels like sort of a lightsaber duel, almost, from a good Star Wars movie. There's a psychology behind it. I really, really like the entire final battle, with an exception, but I think I can talk about this more in my dislikes.
Yeah, I thought so as well. And I was like, oh, they really choreographed this sucker. Like, it was really fun to watch. And I totally agree.
All right, I guess that finally brings us then to the dislikes. And Chris, I think this is probably the thing that I wanted to put on my list the most, but you got to the Google Doc first, so let's talk about it.
That's the benefits of being the one who typically creates the Google Doc. we both have our distinct roles. I think shelving Mera, for the most part, is incredibly disheartening. And the treatment of the character as a whole is a disappointment. I think I understand the awkward nature of Amber Heard of being involved in this film. I think it's a really slippery slope, regardless of where you stand on that. I don't want this to divulge into whatever, but I think if you're going to keep her in the film, then you can't hide her like this. I get the same vibes that we got with The Rise of Skywalker with Kelly Marie Tran. Literally just hiding her, and then she has a couple of nice moments, so that was refreshing to see. But for the rest of the time, she is bait for the villain, or she is weeping woman over her child. And it's really bad. And I'm not even an Aquaman comic book reader, but I know that Mera is a powerhouse. I know that she carries... I know that I've seen her carry like a solo title. So I know that this is not a character that is a throwaway. And it's really disheartening.
I'll totally agree with that. Mera is actually in my top tier of like top 10 favorite female superhero comic book characters. Like, I absolutely adore Mera. And when she's written well and executed well, she's just a powerhouse, as you said. And I will also say that I really liked Mera generally in the first movie. I think it was a very well-written character. And her dynamic with Arthur was interesting. And I really enjoyed that part of the movie. And yeah, it was super disappointing that Mera is basically... Like, even the moments that you point out that where she has like some nice moments going on in the movie, they immediately then cut away from her again. Like, it feels like they had no choice in the matter. Like, they filmed the movie, right? And then there's this whole controversy, and then they have to cut around that. So mechanically, like in the scene where she saves Arthur, right, after she recuperates from being injured, there was really logically no other way to execute that scene. As it was filmed, right? So like, okay, we're going to leave her there coming in and saving him, but then we immediately cut away and she doesn't really say anything anymore. Like, she had like maybe 5 lines in the whole movie.
Yes.
And I do understand the notion that this is supposed to be like some kind of road trip movie with the two brothers, right? And it's a, like I said, it's a solid concept for the movie. But I feel like there was at least a subplot or something involving Mara that was essentially cut to bits. Like, there are, you can tell that there are pieces missing of this character. It's very, very obvious how fast it cuts around her in places, where you would think that there's some dialogue from her and she just stands there and says nothing. Like, it feels like there are gaps. It is not a good job hiding her at all. It's very much, you feel every time it cuts away from her, like, there was something missing here. Like, she said something or she did something here. And it's so distracting, I think, throughout the movie that it really diminishes the experience. Because every time it cuts away, you're like, wait a minute. Did they just cut around her again because they didn't want her in the movie too much? You know? That's exactly the vibe you get while you're watching the whole thing front to end. And it really did diminish my enjoyment of the movie.
I may be reading too much into this. But there's a really beautiful, heartfelt moment between Arthur and his dad, who Temra Morrison, like, I will go to battle for that man. Like, he never turns in a bad performance. However,
that's a fact.
Arthur makes a toast to single parents. And again, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but with Mara being so absent in this movie, noticeably absent, and him making a toast to single parents, which is lovely towards his dad, but it almost feels like a shot across the bow. Maybe I'm reading too much into that.
It's kind of hard to tell tonally because so much is missing of Mara's story, I think.
Yeah. And so, and I also feel like the script, like, leans into that as well, because when he talks about in his final speech the things that are important to him, he doesn't mention Mara at all. It's all about his son.
Yep.
It's so uncomfortable, and it's very disappointing.
Yes, it is super disappointing.
Dave, it's interesting that you say a subplot might be missing in a movie that is pretty long. And which leads us into your first dislike.
Yeah, I don't know if the juxtaposition of Arthur and his family living at the lighthouse on land, and him, you know, then being king of Atlantis necessarily works, because that entire first part of the movie where they're very jokey about he's a king, but it's like a 9-to-5 job, and he has his you know, his uniform is hanging out on the laundry line and all that. You know, I know they're going for like some kind of cute, like, fish out of water, haha, pun intended, vibe, right? Like, he's the king of Atlantis, but he's still not feels wholly comfortable there. But that entire part of the movie feels really like it just drags, you know? I struggled probably about the first 25, 30 minutes in the movie just to even get into it. There was just not a lot for me to sink my teeth into. And then, you know, it's this, the whole opening montage of him, you know, telling his baby about how he kicked those guys' butts, and then sitting there bored on the throne, and then, you know, washing the laundry, you know, like that whole thing doesn't work, I think, the way it was intended, as this, you know, juxtaposition of like child of two worlds or something. It comes across really awkward and weird. And so I was very, very doubtful that I even wanted to continue watching the movie after about the first 15 minutes or so. I was like, I don't know if this vibe is right. The vibe is such a break, I think, from the vibe of the first movie, the opening of this one, that it took me a while to warm up to it. And I ended up liking it a lot more than I did. And I'm going to be honest with you, I watched the first hour of this movie up until like they get to that island. I watched that like probably a month ago. And then I was kind of just, I stepped away from the movie, and I was like, okay, I think I saw what I needed to see. And then you mentioned you'd like to do a review on it. I was like, I guess I got to watch that second hour now. but yeah, it was very off-putting how much those first 20, 30 minutes dragged for me, I think.
Yeah, I think it would have been a much better choice for them to live in Atlantis and then go visit Grandpa Tom. I think his name's Tom. Like, I think that might have been a much better choice. I didn't really buy, like, the whole King of Atlantis. That's not a 9-to-5 thing. Like, what happens if something happens at 6:30? It's not. And then you're also superheroing on the side as well. It just didn't, like, there were some heartfelt moments and it was cute and endearing, but I don't want to keep going back to this, but they're making me. I think the disconnect with Mara kind of could be a root cause of why it drags, because there's no real chemistry or connection like there was in the first movie. And it's very apparent.
Yeah. And, you know, to a lesser extent, you know, I see a mirror in Arthur there for me, right? Child of two worlds, like, grew up in one world, eventually mm-hmm. has to go to the other world, right? I understand that, you know, when, you know, part European, having grown up in Europe, then move over here. Like, I get that, right? But generally speaking, when you are a child of two worlds, you end up having to pick one, right? I can't live in Europe and the United States at the same time, right? And so a much more relatable thing would have been if he is living with his family, like you said, in Atlantis, and he is still going through a lot of awkwardness of the things that he misses from his previous life, you know? I think that would have been much more relatable and in a much more interesting in for the character and his struggles. So I think the opening really serves the movie very poorly. I think there's a lot more good stuff going on in the movie later on, but it just takes a while to get there. All right, that brings us to your second dislike, which I think your second dislike and my second dislike are closely related. So let's talk about it.
Yeah, so I think that Jason Momoa is a really fun actor. He's real fun-loving, and he makes the movie enjoyable with his kind of aura. However, I think he just can't help himself sometimes, and it steps on some potentially big moments. Like, I was writing for most of that speech at the end, but the lack of mentioning Mara is palpable. And then he just goes completely into, like, a bro moment, and all of that goodwill is just kind of squandered, in my opinion. So
exactly. Yes.
Yeah. And so I enjoy watching the guy on screen, but I don't know. It just doesn't, the puzzle pieces don't fit sometimes, if that makes sense.
It's always been weird. And I think I was so pleasantly surprised when it worked in the first Aquaman. Mm-hmm. It has always been weird to me that the DCEU Aquaman has this bro vibe going on, right? Because that's never been the depiction of Aquaman in the comics, right?
Do you think that they went for this casting because Aquaman has been the butt of so many just jokes about from casuals? Like, that was the long running joke, was Aquaman's lame. Do you think they went in this direction for that reason?
I think that's probably part of it, that they were trying to find a different end to the character. And I'm not saying it can't work, because I really enjoyed the first Aquaman movie. I thought it worked really, really well, right? It's not the depiction of Aquaman I'm most familiar with or that I necessarily enjoy the most. But it worked in the context of the first movie very well. And so I just, you know, I'm pretty chill when it comes to that kind of stuff. I can roll with it, you know, whatever. But I think at some point, the best way to put it is, let me put it this way, okay? Jason Momoa is the actor that I have seen on screen that I would most likely like to go get a beer or 10 with, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he just seems like a really chill, cool dude. The only problem is that in most movies that he seems to be in, he's playing the same cool, chill dude. He spends most of his time basically playing himself. And so that's not necessarily a lot of acting, right? If you're basically just your own personality and just, you know, a heightened version of your own personality on screen. One of the problems that The Rock probably has, as opposed to somebody like Dave Bautista, right? Like, The Rock is always been somebody who basically takes his own personality and just heightens it. That was his whole wrestling performance. And I think in a lot of movies, he comes across the same way. It's just basically a heightened version of him rather than a character that he is trying to inhabit. And I think Momoa struggles with that a little bit too. And I think Aquaman, in this case, didn't do him any favors. You know, like, it would have been good for the movie for him to go through a significant character development here, and instead of seeing being king of Atlantis as this 9-to-5 job, by the time the end of the movie rolls around, he takes it more seriously and with a little gravitas and dignity, right? And so that last speech and the way it ended really felt like, he hasn't learned anything. No, he's still the same dude, right? I think part of Arthur's character here falls a little flat for me. Because of that, because there's not a real clear arc, because Jason Momoa is just Jason Momoa again. And really, I think when you are the king of a nation, it's probably time to grow a little bit beyond the bro mentality, you know? And not saying that that's not part of the character as depicted in these movies, or that that shouldn't be there, but that he should also learn what it takes to be king, right? And that there are moments where maybe you don't let your bro hang out, I guess. It's really hard to quantify what's not hitting in this movie with Aquaman's depiction, because it worked in the first one quite well. But maybe you're right. Maybe there are just some moments where they leaned into it where they shouldn't have, where they should have pulled back, and then it would have clicked better. But they really don't pull back. It's pretty much like that the whole time. The best moment to me, where I feel like maybe Arthur is moving forward and growing as a person, is that speech that he gives to his brother when they're both holding on to the trident, right?
Yes.
And he tells him, let go. I meant what I said. I have your back. We're in this together. Just let go, and I got this, you know? And it was like, that felt real, I guess, is the best way to put it. Like, he took the moment seriously. And I wish there was more of that.
I think it's a complicated thing, too, because on the one hand, you have some really beautiful cultural representation for Pacific Islander people.
And I love that part of this interpretation of Aquaman. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
So that brings a really fascinating kind of rejuvenation to the character, I think. You see him and his dad doing the haka is really beautiful moment at the end of the film, I believe. But I think when it comes to, in that respect, I think the onus is on the creative team to take this force that is goodwill, tender-hearted, fun-loving, full of piss and vinegar, if you will, and kind of channel that towards something. And so, like, there are moments where it works for me, like when he's in the council meeting and his genuine care for both worlds helps him to kind of buck up against this council that if we do reveal ourselves to the surface world, we're going to wipe them out. And so that elements like that work where he can kind of channel that energy. But some of it is just like unbridled, like if he's a canister of something, it's just spilling out of the sides and it's not really directed towards anything for large swaths of this film, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. And I think that was basically both of our second dislikes.
Right.
So I'm gonna go ahead and I'm gonna throw it back to you for your final dislike. And we're circling back around to your Tommy Boy comparison.
Yeah, well, here's the Tommy Boy drawback, is I don't buy them as brothers. I don't. Patrick Wilson is a very fine actor. He, in certain scenes, I feel like he's in a different movie. He doesn't just... And I know that you had mentioned, it brought this to my attention, that he had worked with Juan previously. I remember Insidious, him being the dad in Insidious. And so that makes sense, those connections. But I don't know what it is. Like, there are some really good big speeches that both of them have. But it still feels like David Spade and Chris Farley as, like, reluctant team members or co-workers. It did not feel like brothers. There's nothing that really feels like brothers. They have a couple of nice moments with Nicole Kidman, but even that aspect, it's hard to see Nicole Kidman as their mom. I don't know the age difference, but like it's comics. So, I mean, I'm not going to try to make too much out of it. But at the end of the day, they have a nice relationship that goes on this great journey, but it still feels like almost like Guardians of the Galaxy, where like they can't stand each other, but then now they like each other, or they tolerate each other, or they learn something together. It just doesn't feel like brothers to me. I don't know. I don't know what's escaping there.
Yeah, I agree with this a lot, and I ride for Patrick Wilson a lot, so I want to make sure very clear here that I don't think there's anything wrong with his portrayal of Orm here at all. In fact, I think he does a really fine job of portraying a man who has to sort of face his preconceived notions a little bit, you know, like everything that he'd been taught about, you know, if Arthur shows up, he's going to take your throne and you have to be mistrustful and he's not really your family. And I think the way he portrays actually spending time with him, getting to know him, and then kind of like coming around to seeing that there are things that Arthur may do better, you know, is actually a really interesting journey. So I really like him in this role. But I think there is a chemistry disconnect maybe between Jason Momoa and Patrick Wilson where the familial part of it never clicks, right? It never feels like two brothers reconciling. It feels like two strangers developing begrudging respect. But it never feels like family reconciling. And I think that could have been the heart of the movie, right? Should have been the heart of the movie if this is the movie you're going to make, and I don't think it quite clicked.
All right, so staying on the theme of drawbacks and dislikes to an element that we did like, Dave, what is your third and final dislike?
I really did not like the final resolution of the Black Manta arc. I think the fact that you get to the point where him and Arthur are fighting. I understood the possession storyline to a certain extent because they wanted to power up Black Manta a little bit so he can stand more toe-to-toe with the Atlanteans. Okay, I get that. But by the time we have this big face-off between the two characters, it's arguably not even Black Manta anymore because he starts referring to you wear the clothes of my brother, but you're half the man he was, right? So it's already the king of Necron or whatever that kingdom was called. It's not even Black Manta anymore, right? And then they go ahead and turn it around, and the climax of the movie isn't the big resolution of the grudge of Black Manta against Arthur. No, the resolution is that Aquaman throws a trident at the zombified, monsterfied king that is coming back to life and instantly kills him, basically, with one throw, and that's the climax, right? And I found that really sad because I think Black Manta was really building nicely through this movie. And I think the resolution of the movie should have been actually focused on the Black Manta character, not on this king, which is a non-character in the movie, really. Like, there's nothing interesting going on with this guy. He's just a threat from the past that is re-emerging. Whereas Black Manta was going through quite an arc, you know, deal with the devil to try to get revenge for his father's death. There's so much juice there. And I think they dropped the emotional heft of that a little bit at the end. They dropped the ball there. They could have done so much more with the resolution of that storyline than they did. And I found it disappointing because Black Manta was so solid throughout the movie. So for him to sort of be pushed aside for a different villain, which then was dispatched in about 2.2 seconds, was disappointing to me.
Yeah, I'll even raise that and say that it's an entire two movie arc that was solid and had a really dissatisfying resolution. I even thought that we were kind of going to get it where Arthur helps him up when he's about to fall. Like, I thought that was going to be a nice revisit of where he didn't save his father, but he did save him, but didn't really go anywhere with that.
Yeah, it was a great big missed opportunity. All right, that brings us to final verdict, Chris. If you had to give Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom a grade, what would it be?
I think I'm going to go B-. Like, it's a really, really fun time, but the Mara stuff is just too hard for me to overlook, and it saps a good deal of the points there. I can overlook like some of my other dislikes, but that one's jarring for me.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I almost feel like B-, C+ is sort of where it's at. It's a really, really fun movie that I think if they would have not done the whole Mara exorcism there and tried to remove her as much as possible from the movie, I think we would have probably gotten a more enjoyable movie. It's a fun ride, I think, overall. with some weak spots and some missed opportunities. It is a heck of a lot better than The Flash was. Yeah, oh my god.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think it necessarily lives up to the first Aquaman movie either, which was just a real special movie, I think. It really worked. And I even went so far as to buy the Blu-ray because I really enjoyed that first Aquaman movie so much. And this one does not quite live up to that.
There's no film that I buy physical media for, but I understand.
which brings me to, how do you feel about this movie as the swan song of the DCEU?
Oh. I find really hard to gauge, because so much of the DCEU I have genuinely strongly disliked, and there have been elements that I did enjoy. The first Shazam film was a highlight. Fury of the Gods was okay. It's interesting because these two franchises in particular, Shazam and Aquaman, I greatly enjoyed the first ones and enjoyed the second ones enough, but not as much as the first one. So it's a similar trajectory.
And then there's Wonder Woman, which had a fantastic first movie and a really poor second show.
Actively bad second one. Which, kind of thinking back to our review of that one, I was being way too nice. But
yeah, I think we were both trying desperately to find the positives in that one.
Yeah, I think I'm so desperately ready for a fresh start, and I hope this works. I hope Superman Legacy lives up to the hype. I hope all of this delivers and we have actually good content coming from Warner Brothers. I think the fact that Warner Brothers is involved gives me some trepidation. Probably the most trepidation out of anything is the Walter Zaslav, I'm combining Warner Brothers.
Hamada and Zaslav.
Yeah, David Zaslav. I think David Zaslav is the Lex Luthor of Lex Luthors, like, that could possibly remove the pin in all of this and make it crumble. So I think that's like my biggest worry going forward. But that was a tangent. I think this was like, I've used this metaphor. This is like the person you've needed to break up with for a long time. This was like one final hangout or date that was a decent enough time, but it's still an awkward goodbye.
Yeah. And very clearly this was not intended as the swan song, right? This is just how the release dates and everything shook out. So it doesn't feel like it's really putting, an exclamation point at the end of the DCEU or going out necessarily on a big high note or anything. When it comes to the DCEU, I feel like maybe one day we need to do like sort of a post-mortem episode where we kind of dive through like what the best and worst parts of it were. Just to kind of prepare ourselves for the clean start. But they're very clearly, I guess the DCEU died the way it lived, as a decidedly mixed bag, you know? Mm-hmm. Alrighty, folks, there you have it. What did you think of Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom? Find us on social media, at Nerd by Word, or individually That Nerd Dave, or at That Nerd Chris. We'd love to hear your thoughts. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, it's time for our recommendations of new nerdy media, or old nerdy media, or whatever we are consuming that we're really enjoying right now. Nerd commendations are just around the corner. Stick around. Welcome back, ladies and gentle nerds. It's time for our weekly Oh, yes, it's time for us to recommend some nerdy media to you. And Chris, I'm excited to see what you have on offer this week. What have you got?
Dude, I'm telling you what. The Ultimate Universe is keeping me coming to Marvel Comics right now. I think it's far and away like the strength of the publishing line. And Ultimate X-Men is no exception there. Ultimate X-Men is written and drawn by the incomparable, the wonderful Peach Momoko. And it's interesting that this came up in our conversation during the big talk about Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, or one way or another, we kind of went off on a tangent about the introduction of subgenres into comic book movies. But I think it's also equally important in comic books themselves. And Dave, you're going to love this series as a horror aficionado, specifically if you enjoy Japanese horror. Like, this comic book brought me right back to something like The Grudge, or there are similar other movies that came around in the early to mid 2000s that were of the same vein. It's really spooky and creepy. I will say that there is a content warning for suicidal ideation. So there is some tough subject content for this. But you have Peach Momoko just firing on all cylinders on writing and art, and it's a completely unique branch of this Ultimate Universe. You still have the overarching storyline with the Maker not allowing all these people to become heroes, but then you have, it's kind of on brand for us, Dave, is you have like this middle school graduation taking place as the plot, the subline, albeit in Japan, but then you have some really dark events that take place, and it's just really spooky and creepy, and it's wholly unique, and it's unlike any other reading experience you'll get in Big Two comics, man. I'm kind of playing my cards close to the vest here because I don't want to reveal too much. I want you to experience this firsthand. But like, these first two issues have been really, really kind of stop what you're doing and go read these.
I can't wait. I have not had a chance really to read much over the last few weeks, and I am quite desperate to get back into reading. It's difficult sometimes to get in the right frame of mind and the right atmosphere to really do some heavy reading. But I'm desperate to get back into it. And this was one, even before the first issue came out, I really went to bat for already on social media because there were a lot of people complaining about the art style.
Which is wild.
And I was like, have you lost your mind? It's Peach Momoko. Like, how can you
even
about
criticizing
this?
Not the name Peach Momoko? Is that a real name? What are you talking about?
I don't know what to tell you, man. All I know for sure is this. One of the things that we desperately need in comic books is variety, and not just necessarily variety of genre, but also variety of art style. And not every book should look exactly the same. Yes. You know, I love variants in art like that, and taking different approaches to a franchise and to the art of a franchise. And so I'm really looking forward to reading this, and it kind of sailed right past me that it's even already come out. So I need to really like buckle down and read this ASAP because I've been very excited for it for a while now.
All right, so we are kind of, I don't know if this is a nerd commendation, but it's a recommendation nonetheless.
Oh, it's a nerd commendation, my friend. It's a nerd commendation. So I have been lately on a bit of a procedural rampage. I'm really a fan of procedural mystery shows, harkening back to my original love of all loves, Columbo, right? And so I've kind of gotten into that again. I spent a long time rewatching on HBO Max the entirety of The Mentalist, which is a mystery show that very much feels like some of that old USA network. We've got characters kind of thing, like procedural, but with like a really weird twist, right? And then I was looking for something else to watch and came across a series that I used to watch a little bit and never actually sat down and fully watched through, and that is a show called Castle, currently streaming on Hulu. And I have to admit, I did not realize how nerdy this show got as it went along. So it's a procedural show that revolves around a mystery novelist by the name of Rick Castle, which is portrayed by Nathan Fillion, who starts to shadow an NYPD detective by the name of Kate Beckett, which is performed by Stana Katic, and he basically is shadowing her, and they start having sort of this very unconventional partnership where he has these flights of fancy as a writer, basically trying to always find a story that makes sense. And she's a really solid detective, and so you put the two together and they solve crimes together. Yeah, fine, okay, whatever. I like procedurals, so give me a murder mystery of the week and I'm happy. But the more the show gets along, the nerdier it gets. The character of Rick Castle is just a giant nerd, and you get all sorts of stuff that he does that is about as nerdy as it gets. There's a whole episode that's basically set at a comic book convention. He's constantly playing with lightsabers and stuff, and the flights of fancy he has in trying to solve some of the cases involve topics like alien abduction and time travel and all this really weird science fictiony stuff. Now, I will admit, in most cases, by the end of the episode, those theories get solidly disproven. But the journey there is such a fun, nerdy romp of basically having a non-nerd in the NYPD detective having to put up with this incredibly nerdy guy nerding out over everything he runs into for 45 minutes. It ends up being a lot of fun and feels like it mirrors a little bit my own life sometimes, because I spend so much time nerding out about things and there's always somebody around me who has no idea what I'm talking about and has to roll their eyes at me. So as a nerd, I relate to this show. So I think the mysteries are really solid. I think the acting in the show is really solid. The relationships in the show are really solid. But, you know, as somebody who likes procedurals and has watched a ton of them, I think the thing that really keeps me coming back to this is just the unabashed nerdiness of the main character and how that constantly feeds into the narrative in some way, shape, or form. The episode that involved time travel, for example, that I watched most recently, I think it's a season 5 episode, actually is the first episode where they don't come out at the end and solidly say, this is not real. They kind of leave you hanging a little bit, like, was it time travel or are all these people just kind of crazy, you know? And so I really appreciate that nerdy undertone that runs through this show. And so I think if you're a nerd, you might find this to be a procedural that you can appreciate just because it has such a strong nerdy undertone in it. So I really enjoy Castle. It's currently streaming on Hulu. There are 8 seasons. I'm currently on season 5, I think. And it's a solid watch.
So that's really surprising, because this was nowhere on my radar, but you harken back to things like Columbo, like Psych, like Monk, and Elementary. I remember when Elementary was coming out weekly. That was appointment television, so this might be something.
This is Murder, He Wrote. That's what this is, man. It's Murder, He Wrote. That's what this is. So if you're willing to trade Nathan Fillion for Angela Lansbury, this is your show, okay?
might be strong enough to rope me in.
Alrighty, folks, there you have it. This was a new episode of The Nerd Byword. If you enjoy what you just heard, get on your favorite podcasting platform, drop us a rating and review, and subscribe so you never miss another episode. You can find our podcast wherever podcasts are available. TuneIn Radio, Spotify, oh my goodness, we're everywhere, Apple Podcasts, and on our very own website, nerdbyword.com, which currently is down for maintenance, but should be back in just about a week or so with some big improvements under the hood to make things a lot easier to navigate for you folks.
And if you also like what you heard, or you have commentary on our takes, if we were completely off base, please hit us up on social media at Nerd By Word on all social platforms, or individually, That Nerd Dave and That Nerd Chris. And as always, stay well and stay nerdy.
The Nerd By Word is written and produced by Chris and Dave, two nerds with a love of all things pop culture. The podcast features music by Al Jimenez, with additional drops composed by Joe Biondi. Our show art is by Ashery Design. Find us at nerdbyword.com and wherever podcasts are available.